Lord, we thank you so much for your grace and your mercy and your kindness and how you have gathered us all from different ways of life, different places, and gathered us here tonight under the banner of your gospel. And tonight, Lord, as we look at all of the wonderful provisions you've given us, I just pray that you would cause us to just long to dig deeper into your word and use all that you have provided just to for the goal of seeing your son and the perfect redemption we have in him. Amen. Okay, let's dive in. Today what we're going to do is look at what I've called tools of the trade. Look at the many tools that we as 21st century Christians in America are blessed to have to aid us in understanding the scriptures. And like I said, what I'm going to do today is I'm going to go through, by no means is this an exhaustive list here. This is just we're just scratching the surface here, tip of the iceberg. So I brought just a few samples out of my library to give everybody an idea of what some of this stuff looks like, and I'm going to pass it around so you can take a look at it. A lot of this stuff is very basic here, but I think it helps to be able to take a look at it and see what it looks like firsthand. So to start off with, what I want to start off with tonight is biblical background helps. Now, as we've progressed through the course, we've noted how much historical context is an important asset to understand in our endeavoring of wrestling with the scriptures to come to a proper understanding. Now, let me give you a couple examples here. For instance, here's one this is kind of a classic work. It's called the New Testament Background. And this has been somewhat of a standard for a while. And what this is ancient writings. This is the New Testament background. Ancient writings that aren't in the Bible, obviously, but it's the background. And what's interesting is when you read a lot of these writings, you'll see how the New Testament writings are in this time of history, because you'll see parallels in literary style. And I think it in one sense helps illuminate literary and historical background of that which the New Testament came out of. So if you want to take a look at that one. The next one, this was actually a text that was written by one of my professors in my undergrad, Carl Rasmussen, who is the professor of Old Testament. I don't know if he's still there or not, but as of a couple years ago, he was the professor of Old Testament at Bethel College. And this is it's a fascinating book. It's an atlas, but there's not only is it an atlas showing the geography of the times and the places of the Bible, but it's very well written in putting a lot of these things into context, relating these places and these times to what we see in the Bible. So I really highly recommend something like this, just to familiarize yourself with, again, the historical and cultural background of the Scriptures. So this is another thing you can pass around. These were two texts that I ended up getting last year. I took a course. It was a fantastic course. It was called Second Temple Judaism. And basically what the course was exploring what Judaism was like from right about the time of the exile all the way through what's called the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135 AD. And a couple texts, if there is one section of history that you really want to study that will really illuminate, it's that time. So much of the Bible is written in that period. And One here, this is a real basic text, an introduction to early Judaism. And this just goes through the time, things of like the time of the Second Temple and Jewish literature at that time and institutions, for instance, the Sadducees and Pharisees. You know, we read about the Sadducees and the Pharisees in the Scriptures, and we know their names well. But the truth is we have a whole wealth of information regarding these two groups. And when we understand these two groups and their theologies, because they both had distinctive theologies, it really helps illuminate the New Testament. When we see them arguing with Jesus about the resurrection, understanding the historical background is significant, because the Sadducees denied that there was going to be a bodily resurrection, whereas the Pharisees affirmed it. So when you take that historical background and place it within the context, when we see that discussion in the Gospels, it takes on added significance, and we understand the text better because of that. Another primary source of information which has revolutionized scholarship as far as biblical scholarship is the Dead Sea Scrolls. The guy that I took my Second Temple Judaism class from, his name was Michael Wise, and he is a professor and scholar that's stationed at Northwestern, but he taught the class at Bethel Seminary. And he's considered one of the top scholars and experts on the Dead Sea Scrolls in the world. So it was a blessing to take a class from him. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, what the Dead Sea Scrolls are, was in Qumran, which is in the Middle East. In Qumran, there was a boy that was out taking a hike, and he stumbled across a cave. And he went into the caves, and he found all sorts of scrolls. And ultimately, scholarship archaeologists came and scholars got their hands on them. And there are many, many caves. And this is the product. This book is the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Dead Sea Scrolls basically are a group of writings from a sect. A lot of people thought they were from the Essenes, but a lot of modern scholarship has challenged that, so most of the time they just are called the Qumran community. And they had a lot of writings which referenced the Old Testament. A lot of their writings were, in some way, you see foreshadows of what was going on in the New Testament. There was some really interesting expectation in the Dead Sea Scrolls. For instance, there's one particular scroll about Melchizedek, which really focuses on Melchizedek somehow as this having future prophetic significance. And as we read Hebrews, he does, but in what Melchizedek has to say about Jesus. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, they're difficult, and when you read them, some of the scrolls aren't preserved great, so you'll get a lot of dot, 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 then words. But nevertheless, it is probably considered the Dead Sea Scrolls are probably considered the biggest archaeological find of the 20th century. So, yeah. An Introduction to Early Judaism by James Vanderkam. And I do think this is a profitable text, a real good historical text. So that's New Testament and Old Testament background. Any questions on anything there? Any questions about the Dead Sea Scrolls? Any questions about Old Testament, New Testament background?
Maybe these books cover it too, but you know, I've always looked for a historical text that would give a good background, either like the second century, like Polycarp, forward, mm-hmm. you know, because there just doesn't seem to be much written, and you don't want to stumble on a whole bunch of heretical things. Is there anything in that era that you kind of...
You know, there, I'll get back to you with the specific text, but I know there is a lot of text. And what she's talking about really is the writings of the early church fathers. And actually, probably the best place to read the early church fathers, and we're going to get to this in a little bit, there are some great software that has the writings of the early church fathers. The reason why I think that is better is, number one, there is a massive amount of writings of the early church fathers, and with the software that I've seen used before, it's very handy, and we'll get into that in a moment. But I think they're good to study. But again, I think you noted a real good caveat, and that's the need to be very discerning when we read the early church fathers. There is some quote unquote heretical. I mean, the thing is we have you have early church father writing, and then you have this thing called the pseudepigrapha, which is writings like, if you've ever seen the Gospel of Thomas or something like that. The Gospel of Thomas was not written by Thomas, and that's a Gnostic writing. So I a couple months ago I preached and I noted how I went into a Christian bookstore. Oh no, it wasn't a Christian bookstore. It was like a Barnes and Nobles or a Borders. And I ran into a text. It said the lost books of the Bible and the forgotten books of Eden. And I'm a young Christian thinking, oh, here's some books of the Bible that were lost. I better take a look at these. So I actually went and bought it and took it home. And there were just some of the oddest. I mean, right away I was just struck by how different it was from my New Testament. How different the doctrine was, how different the style was. Very different from my New Testament, especially when you read, I can't remember which Gnostic gospel it was, but at the end of one Gnostic gospel, I got to the end of it, and Peter was upset that Mary was with them. And he says, women aren't fit for the kingdom of God. And then Peter's response was, don't worry, I'm going to make her a man. That is that's very Gnostic there. And that's very foreign to what we read in the New Testament. I mean, look at the resurrection accounts. It was the women who saw Jesus first. So, good to look at, good to study, very good to understand that background and that which came after. I'm going to talk a little bit about church history if we have time, but church history is also good to read. Yeah.
I just got done reviewing a DVD series called Amazing Grace. It's the history and theology of Calvinism, and it's put out by a group called the apologeticsgroup.com. And what I really found valuable in this was that it goes back, it's like three different sections, and the first section goes back and takes a look at the different church councils going back to the Church of Nicaea, and, you know, looks at the debates between Augustine and Pelagius to start with, and then talks about between Luther and Erasmus, and then Calvin and Arminius. Mm-hmm. And it goes off of premise that, you know, if we forget what has happened in the past, we're bound to repeat it. Mm-hmm. And so it's so valuable to know, and especially what heresies have come in the past to the church and how the pastors and lay people have dealt with these statements and have basically overturned them. And as a result, we have this Reformed theology that has come mm-hmm. through the ages. And of course, the most popular is Calvinism. But what's interesting to note is that the 5 points of Calvinism is actually a rebuttal to 5 points that Arminius first put forth. That
the Remonstrance is what that was called. There was the 5 points of the Remonstrance, and then the Synod of Dort was a response to that.
Yeah,
and that was called the work again?
The DVD?
Yeah, the DVD.
It's Amazing Grace, and it's the history and theology of Calvinism, and it's put out by it's apologeticsgroup.com, if you want to go out and just do a Google search.
Another good, if you're interested about things like that, there's a there's a book which is very profitable. It's kind of an interesting, real short snippet of the theology of church history and the battles over theology. It's called The Doctrines That Divide by Erwin Lutzer. Written at a very good lay level, but he lays out the issues very well. He talks of, he brings up baptism and the battles that have gone on over baptism, the Lord's Supper, free will and sovereignty, things of that nature. It's called The Doctrines That Divide by Erwin Lutzer. Or Lutzer. I don't know for sure how to pronounce his last name.
I've got a video series that's called That the World May Know, produced by Focus on the Family.
Okay.
The narrator is Ray Vanderlyn. He's a Hebrew scholar, and I don't know, he's got some other credentials, but he takes college students through the Holy Lands and does Bible teaching, and there's some animation, and it's different segments, as so you could use it like in a Bible study type situation, and I found that, I've watched it several times, and it just brings the Bible to life to see where Jesus was standing, and he's reading the passages of what he was talking about, and it's just very good.
Cool.
I'd recommend it.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I'm not very up to snuff on a lot of the DVDs out there right now. I'm sure there's some really good ones, so I'm a little bit more of a bookworm when it comes to this stuff, but I guess I'm a little old-fashioned. Anything else anybody wants to bring up about biblical background? And anyway, thank you for sharing that. And yeah, the biblical background helps are wonderful. Now I want to get into Bible translations. We promised we would get to this first week. We talked a little bit about translation, but more of how it was done. Now we're going to talk about really some of the specifics and how it relates to how we understand the Scriptures. Rather than giving I am more than willing to answer questions that anybody has about certain versions, and I would... or translations, I would give you my best answer on what I think of them or my opinion on them. But what I want to do is give you the three types of translations that we see out there. The first type of translation is what's called the formal equivalent. And what formal equivalent does is, as much as possible, tries to keep a one-on-one correspondence with the translation of the Greek word as much as possible. Now, if you know anything about Greek, Greek is reads very different than English. So there always needs to be a certain amount of arranging of the words and the phrases in order for it to make sense. But formal equivalent, as much as possible, tries to keep it really a word for word. So a formal equivalent, think of it as being formal. Another type of translation is the dynamic equivalent. And oftentimes this is more of what is called a thought for thought. They may take a chunk or a phrase, and this is very loose, it depends on what particular version you're looking at, and there's a spectrum here, but a dynamic equivalent really may take a phrase and translate that phrase into how they think would translate best to English. And finishing it off, then you have what is called a paraphrase. And a paraphrase is often not even taken from the... Actually, there's only really two major paraphrases, but paraphrases are really not taken from the Greek or the Hebrew. It's more or less looking at... It's more or less a person looking at the text itself and giving their own thoughts and ideas about the text, trying to rephrase it in a way that they think, who knows, may sound good, or they think captures the text better. I'll say flat right off the bat, I am not a fan of paraphrases. the two main paraphrases out there. One is the Living Bible, not to be confused with the New Living Translation. That was actually a translation, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. But the Living Bible is very much a paraphrase, and if you read it, you will really see it. Another paraphrase, one which is probably much more renowned right now, is The Message. That's written by Eugene Peterson. Now, I hear Eugene Peterson, I hear he used Greek and Hebrew when doing it, but I don't, from what I've read of The Message, I don't think that really mattered a bit. Brian, you want to go to the mic? I'm sorry, I feel like I'm such an ogre doing that.
I'm not even sure if The Message qualifies as a paraphrase, because a dictionary defines a paraphrase as saying the same thing in a different way. Mm-hmm. Well, he doesn't say things in a different way. He says things that are completely different,
right,
not just a different way of saying the same thing. He changes the meaning completely. So
I would agree with you. If we were looking at the definition in the dictionary, that which we find in the dictionary, yeah, it probably wouldn't match up with that. But under these headings that are used widely, this is called a paraphrase. That's what most people will call it. But yeah, I would agree with you that if you're looking at the dictionary, that what you or the, in Webster's definition of a paraphrase really doesn't even match up. And we'll see that in a second here. I took one text. One out of the New American Standard, one out of the New Living, and one out of the Message. And we'll see how this difference is demonstrated when we look at it. Before we get to that, we'll take a question.
Okay, before you get to that, can you give examples for 1 and 2 of which Bible falls into formal and which Bible falls into dynamic?
Okay.
Or you don't want to do that.
No, I'll do that. The New American Standard is probably the best formal equivalent, I think. That's an example. I think both the New King James Version and the Old King James Version were both formal equivalents. From what I understand, the NIV is more of a hybrid between formal equivalent and dynamic equivalent. That help? New English Bible? I don't know. I'll look into it and get back to you. Do you know?
ESV.
I think the ESV is a more of a formal. Oh, the ESV? Okay, yep. That's why I didn't know it. I think the ESV, the English Standard Version, is a, from what I've read on it, that is a formal. Formal. What's that?
Amplified?
I'd have to look at the Amplified a little closer. But I know the Amplified is a unique Bible, so everybody kind of familiar with the Amplified, it gets to certain words, and then it gives you a couple words that seem to quote-unquote amplify it. As far as the method of translation, I know of the Amplified Bible, but I'd have to look into that. I'll look into that and get back to you next week on what more that is. The truth is, when we get to a lot of these other translations, I think a lot of the other translations are very much a hybrid of the formal and the dynamic equivalent. Okay, the difference demonstrated here. I just went and looked at a passage, Romans 8:29, something that most of us are probably familiar with, a text which is, well, Romans 8 is a famous chapter, and if you've gone here for any amount of time, we're in Romans 8 a lot because it's such a wonderful piece of scripture. Let's just read these three, and I think this will show you the difference. The New Living Translation is the one that I chose. I think the New Living Translation is a very good example of dynamic equivalence. Now, the New Living Translation is different from the Living in that I think it's Tyndale had the idea of, well, the living Bible is cherished by a lot of people, but it's not a translation, and it gets ripped because of that so much. Let's see if we can stay true to the spirit of the Living Bible and make a translation out of it. So they underwent that project, and it came out with a New Living Translation. Here are the differences. Let's just read the same verse three times over in these different translations or paraphrases. Romans 8:29 in the New American Standard, "For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to become conformed to the image of his Son, so that he would be the firstborn among many brethren." Okay, that's New American Standard. And if you would go to a Greek text, you would be able to really see the one-on-one correspondence with many of these words. Romans 8:29, "For God knew his people in advance, and he chose them to become like his Son, so that his Son would be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters." So we see a couple differences there. We see, for instance, the Romans 8:29 uses, in the New American Standard, uses brethren, and that's really, or brothers, and that really is the word that is in the Greek text. And the New Living Translation is gender neutral, is what they say in Bible translator lingo. They would say many brothers and sisters. So they are doing some theology for you. And I would agree that women are included in the term brethren, and that is intended there. I just am not sure whether we should be translating that way. And I'll give you an example why in a second. Now we get to the message. Romans 8:29. This is Eugene Peterson. "God knew what he was doing from the very beginning. He decided from the outset to shape the lives of those who would love him along the same lines as the life of his Son. The Son stands first in the line of humanity he restored." So I hope now you can see why I'm not a big fan of paraphrases, and especially the message. I don't think this captures at all that which is being proclaimed in the original manuscript. I think there are a whole lot of foreign ideas in this text. Yeah.
Several of my kids went to Seattle Pacific University, where Eugene Peterson is from. They publish a monthly magazine called The Response, and the one that just came out is all about biblical illiteracy. Mm-hmm. Surveys have been done showing that lots of people in the church are very biblical illiterate. But then they're featuring Eugene Peterson,
yeah.
And the message.
Yeah,
and
ironic.
And they've got a whole project as to how they're going to help people
yeah.
become more literate in the Bible. And yet I read that and I.
Well, I hope they don't read the message.
Well, no, but I mean it was just interesting because it was a prominent part of this article, and I'm kind of going, well, is there a project to get the message out to more people or whatever. I haven't read the whole magazine, but it was just timely to what you're talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing that. I agree with you. I think it's very troubling. And if we want to get out of biblical illiteracy, we don't want to be reading the message because we look here. This is just one example. I could have used a whole heck of a lot more.
One more on the message. December 5th, 2003, we did a Sunday school having to do with this purpose-driven life thing that was getting a little bit big, and we hadn't seen a whole lot on it. We talked about the fact they used the message and said, this is not a good translation. Somebody came up afterward and said, give me an example. I said, open the book, pick one. It'll be wrong. Anyway, and that was just betting on what was going on. But they opened the book. They ended up with, I think it's chapter 24, reference 24, just remembering that, and it happened to be Romans 12, 1 and 2. I said, okay, read the message, read the verse. We read the verse, got it, okay, then read the message concept, couldn't recognize it.
Yeah.
It was that far off. I mean, it wasn't even close to the same concept.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. Thanks for sharing that. A good example. And I know that there's been several passages brought up where the exact opposite of the intention of the text has really been brought up. So it's just a good rule of thumb to stay away from paraphrases because, again, this goes back to, number one, humility. I think this is very prideful, and I think this is very dangerous to do this to the Word of God. and pass it off as this is some sort of Bible. And, you know, we want to handle accurately the word of truth. And I think this is a demonstration of how we, what we are to avoid this type of thing. Yeah.
Well, you hear the skeptics of people say, well, the Bible's wrote by man and it's full of errors and all of this kind of stuff. Well, when the scribes translated, they took very careful procedures in what they did. And when we see this stuff, the world comes at us throwing this in our face.
Mm-hmm.
Could you address that a little bit of, you know, how this develops?
Well, I think that, number one, we need to be discerning. And it's good to be educated about this type of stuff. And, you know, at the beginning, or if you remember in the first class, I talked about textual criticism. And, you know, somebody comes and looks at the message and says, you know, look at how off you are. These two things don't even say the same thing, and they're both supposed to be Bibles. Well, number one, that has nothing to do with, because a translation is wrong, does nothing to affect the truth of the Word of God. Because, again, remember when I began the class, when we say the Word of God is the inspired, inerrant Word of God, we're speaking of the original manuscripts. Not necessarily a translation. Translation is only inspired and inerrant when it accurately conveys that which was originally written. So I think that's really what we want to be ready to tell the skeptics. And yeah, they'll say that. They'll keep saying stuff like that. And you might tell them that, and they'll still believe what they want to believe. But, you know, you told them the truth. Yeah.
I don't know if you'll remember the title, but I met with Bob Tuesday night because I had a friend that was skeptical about the accuracy of the Bible. And he went through a lot of church history, but he referenced a book, and I believe it was the Introduction to the New Testament, a really blasé title.
Okay.
But it went through all of church history and how the canon was put together and why and who. And
I wonder if that was Geisler's work. I know Bob talks about Geisler's work very highly. Norman Geisler, I know.
Yes, that was the one. Really, Bob said it was probably the best book he's found to prove the accuracy of the early writings of the church.
Cool. Thank you. Yep. Okay. Any other questions on translations? Yes.
I'm not sure because I'm sorry I came late, but can you also talk about, I know generally about it, but not the specifics, that there are different original texts that are, not the original, but manuscripts found. There's the Alexandrian Textus Receptus, and how that plays into certain translations.
We did go over that in the first class, but I'll rehash it real quick again. There really are two big texts. There's the received texts, and then there's the, well, majority texts. There's actually a bunch of them, but those are really the two that kind of are always highlighted. And basically, the received text is a certain body of text. There's the Alexandrian and the Byzantium. And the Alexandrian is that which is kind of the more of the majority text. And what the majority text does is the majority looks at all of the manuscripts that we have and then does what's called textual criticism to see if there was any scribal errors, which sometimes there were, but, you know, the scribes were very careful, and then come up with a text based on all of the criticism that they did on all these texts to see that which is the original, trying to get back to the original. So that's one line, and then there's the Byzantium, which is another line which ignores a whole bunch of texts. And the thing is, and this is when we go back to the King James controversy, this is really what that's all about. I think the modern textual criticism is the best. I mean, when we have new archaeological discoveries and find ancient manuscripts, we want to look at them. Just because they were found, you know, recently doesn't mean they have nothing to tell us about the text. So that's the problem with the received text, or with looking at only the Textus Receptus.
Is it also the news in the title always talking about the Byzantium and the KJV?
They actually, from what I understand, and I'll look into this more and make a correction next week if it's not right. The New King James Version did use other texts, other than just. But I don't know if new simply means that. I'm not sure about that. It may be, but I've never heard that before. But the original King James was just the Textus Receptus, and there's a couple other ones that are just based on the received text. And that doesn't mean that the received text is absolutely horrible. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff there. It's just we want to consider all the evidence. I think that is the most balanced way to look at textual criticism. If you want to hear more about this, we did go into this in the first week about the text. It's rather involved. It's kind of heady, but it's how we get our Bible. Anything else? Anybody has to? Any questions about Bible translations? Okay, let's move on. Word study helps. Strong's Concordance is a big one here. Let me find it. Here's a couple things that if I am hard up to look at a Greek word and what it says. Strong's has concordances. Some are good, some are not. There's other concordances other than Strong's, but Strong's is really the most famous. And really, they're handy because they're so user friendly for the most part. You can hear, like, this volume is both a concordance, and it has a Hebrew and Greek dictionary with corresponding Strong's words here. So if you're not computer savvy, which if you're computer savvy, all this stuff gets a lot easier. This is how we manually do it. And for instance, this is an interlinear Greek English New Testament here. And this is one actually based on the Textus Receptus, but it's still not bad. It's still decent. And I'll pass this around. You can see how there's an interlinear shows the original, basically the original text, and then the translation of the word right underneath it. So this, and if you want to look at this, this is very much a demonstration of the formal equivalent in Bible translation here. So that is just an example. There's a whole lot of other Greek and Hebrew helps out there. And this is where we are blessed. You do not have to have a working knowledge or be fluent in Greek and in Koine Greek and in Hebrew to be able to do word studies and things of that nature. We have these tools which, I mean, you go back 50 years, and then go back through all of church history, barely anybody had this. And you had to go and be, if you did want something like this, you had to become educated in Greek and Hebrew through 5-10 years of hard knock schooling. And we have this stuff at our fingertips. Unfortunately, so many people, I mean, I agree with the article. We are in a state of biblical illiteracy right now. And the problem is we have all this food and we're not feeding on it. So I'll pass these around and you can take a look at them. These, you can tell these were ones I've used a little bit more than others. talking more about Greek. I'll have you pass this around too. There are some really good resources if you want to learn biblical Greek. There's some very good resources out there. You can go spend $30 to $40 at a bookstore, and I know this comes out with this text now comes with a interactive either CD or DVD-ROM. And you can go and get proficient in biblical Greek studying by yourself for a price of about $30 or $40 if you put in the time and the effort. This was the text that I used when I took Greek in seminary. A real good one by Muntz, William Muntz. And, you can just look at it, and, it goes through The thing is when I learned Greek, I found out I needed to learn a lot more about English, too, when you learn Greek. I wasn't the best student in my English classes when I was in high school, so I had to relearn English to really get a lot out of Greek. But, you know, you get into participles and genitive, and, you know, they do come in, you know, they introduce you right away to introduction to English nouns. So they're teaching you English, too, because you need to learn English if you're going to learn how to translate something and read something in Greek. So here's another one that I have not been through, but I do have this text in my library, and this is Essentials of New Testament Greek. So these, and there's other really good resources out there. So if this is something you want to get into, it's fairly easy. What you need to do is put aside the time and put forth the effort, but I think it's well worth it. So, and this is something that I personally want to continue my knowledge on. So I know they have, I think he has an advanced on this too, so you can keep going in your class and get a real good working knowledge of Greek for, you know, probably with about a half hour to an hour a day if you want to be consistent at it. So. Yeah.
I was just going to make a comment on Strong's, and it's very basic, but for anybody that would be watching this, because if they had never used Strong's before, but, you know, the first ones came out and it was just the King James Version. If you really want to give yourself less of a headache, make sure the Strong's that you get matches the version of the Bible that you're reading.
Yeah, yeah, Strong's have developed. And that's naturally developed with the more translations we've gotten. The interesting thing is, and I was doing some reading on this week, is the King James Version is really only called that in the U.S. for the most part. It's called the Authorized Version in other parts of the world, which I thought was interesting. So, yeah, very good point on that. And you want to be cognizant of that, and that doesn't mean I've used a lot of the Strong stuff that's still with the King James, but you have to have a working knowledge of that. You have to understand that, because if you don't, you aren't going to get a little bit of a headache if you're trying to use that with the New American Standard or something like that. So, good point. Anything else regarding that? And here's a Vines. This is just another one. This is a dictionary, expository dictionary of Old and New Testament words. Again, just Greek and Hebrew helps. Theological dictionaries. Now, theological dictionaries are very helpful. With the next few ones, I've kind of rattled off some of the more prominent ones. There's the IVP Dictionary of series, and that is, and I own one of these volumes, is the Dictionary of Paul and His Letters, and it's basically a collection of a lot of the issues that come up with Paul in his letters. So, you know, for instance, the entry I'm looking at right here is called Gifts of the Spirit. So this is a dictionary of the Pauline teaching and issues and scholarly debates about the gifts of the Spirit in Pauline literature. So, and just a couple other ones. New Dictionary of Theology, Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, or TDNT, New International Dictionary of the Old Testament, some of the more prominent ones that are out there. They're helpful. If you're wrestling with an issue, a lot of times they'll give you a nice, good, concise sketch of what's going on, both scholarly and just primarily in the text of whatever you're studying. Yeah.
Would those dictionary of series, would that be similar to like a topical Bible, like a Knave's topical Bible?
The Knave's topical Bible. From I haven't looked at it in a while, but I think the Knave's topical Bible is basically they have a topic, and then a list of all the scriptures, right? So, yeah, that could be somewhat considered a dictionary, a kind of a combination of a dictionary and a concordance somewhat. But these dictionaries are more or less taking a look at a certain issue and then wrestling with it, really more from a scholarly point of view, kind of highlighting the debates and the interpretive issues that have come up. This is going to go for commentaries also, which we're going to look at next. When it comes to these type of things, they are extremely expensive. You can look at a lot of these series, and some of them can run you hundreds and hundreds of dollars if you're going to get the hard copies. I really recommend getting a library card if this is something you want to pursue. Especially you, because everybody here is, because they can get here every week, you're within driving distance to a seminary library. We actually have two very good seminary libraries in the area here. Luther, you know, theologically they're way off base. They have an excellent seminary library. In fact, I think they're probably the best in the area. Luther has a very good seminary library, lots of books. It's a unique library. You go in and you look up and there's just levels and levels of books. And Bethel has a good seminary library. That's where I go often, mostly because I'm very familiar with the layout. And that's where I did so much of my work when I was there. But you're going to find just a host. And the thing is when you go to a library, as far as Bethel goes, these dictionaries, some of them, they have a section where some of them you can check out, but others are, they stay put. You know they're going to be there because you can't check them out. They have and that goes with some of the commentaries I'm going to note too. Another avenue is software. There are so many software programs out there now that have a bunch of theological dictionaries in them and other interpretive works. And you usually, the bang for your buck you get there, they usually advertise it somewhere on there. If you bought it, they'd say if you bought this in print it would cost $2,000, but here you get it for $79.95 or something like that. So again, if you're computer savvy, software is very recommended here, just to save you money and time. So again, libraries or software, yes?
A couple of points. First one, just to save a little money for you, as a point that where I've learned to save some money, is Luther's bookstore is also very, very good, very well stocked. They can order virtually anything, and I've ordered tons of stuff from them, and most of it comes at 25% off the list.
Okay.
So you can get some good deals there.
And is that just right on the Luther campus there?
Yep.
Okay.
It's in the main building on the lower level.
Okay.
And very, very good resource. The other point I had was wanted to know your thoughts on systematic theology works, like Norman Geisler's work.
Yep. Yeah, thank you. I'd like to address that. First, regarding where Luther is. Luther is basically off of Highway 280 over in St. Paul. So if you're on 94 and you take 280 north, Luther is, I can't remember the exit you take, but it's, what was it? Is it Como? Okay. Yeah, it's up near there. So it's a fairly big campus. That's where Luther is. If you want to go check out the library or the bookstore there, systematic theologies I'd say they're profitable to read. But the thing is what you really got to be careful with systematic theologies is you're reading basically what you're reading is a person's conclusions on reading the biblical text. They're systematizing of all the biblical texts. I have not read Geisler's Systematic Theology, but I have heard good things about it. Millard Erickson has a good systematic theology book. I think it's just called Christian Theology. I think that's what it's called, but it's Millard Erickson. I had to read that in seminary, and I thought it was a solid systematic theology book. What systematic theology books are really good at, what I find them most profitable for, is really to get a handle on the issues in theology as far as overarching things. For instance, you know, what a systematic theology is it'll go through every point of theology in systematically, what we would believe about creation, what you believe about God, what you believe about the person work of Jesus, what you believe about the gifts of the Spirit, what you believe about salvation, what you believe about the end times. You know, basically, a good systematic theology is going to look at all those things. They're going to sketch the diversity of opinion, and then they're usually a good one. Will come to their own conclusion saying this is why this is the most compelling view. So systematic theologies are profitable, but as always, with all this stuff, you know, we want to read all these things with a discerning eye. They're meant to be helps, but we have to be discerning. So thank you for bringing those things up. And that'll lead to study Bibles, I guess, is next. A lot of people bash study Bibles, but, you know, I think they're helpful. And again, I think we want to just be careful with them. I think one of the places where I think study Bibles are extremely helpful is some of the introductory notes, giving a historical background, author, date, occasion, things of that nature. Now, again, you want to read those with a discerning eye, but often I think those are helpful, and I think they're nice and compact to at least help give people a primer. By no means should they be, you know, the extent of your research when doing exposition, but they sometimes are a good, convenient starting point. Now, a good study Bible is only as good as its notes. And let me, there are several study Bibles. You know, some of them some study Bibles really probably shouldn't be called study Bibles. Some are very much, you know, life application Bibles, which more or less is just looking at finding some sort of significance in the text, which isn't actually wrong, but that's not really necessarily study in the way I think of studying, getting into the text, getting into the context of the historical and literary elements of the text in order to come to a proper understanding. Then we go and move on to the application, as we've done in this class. But let me give you a sampling here. The most popular study Bible out there, and this is documented fairly well, is the NIV study Bible. The same study notes in the NIV are available in the NASB study Bible now. That's put out by Zondervan. And for the most part, it can be very profitable. But again, and I've seen this happen so often in Bible studies that I've partaken in, is so many people get down to the notes and say, well, the notes here say this, so that's the answer, as if it's some sort of teacher's key to give you the answer what the text is. It's just not the case. Some notes are better than others. There are very much theological presuppositions going into notes. So you want to be wary of that. And you'll see this as you develop an understanding of various theologies and you read someone's study notes. You'll see, oh, well, this is coming from that particular school of theology, often. For instance, a big one is the Schofield Study Bible. Anybody ever read the Schofield Study Bible? Hands? A few people? It's an old study Bible, but the study notes are very clearly from a certain theological perspective, and often a wrong theological perspective. So that's the NIV. You want to pass this one around? I'll give you the MacArthur. You know what? I'll give you all three of these instead of making you. I don't want to make you run too much. Another good one, and this is one that I use very often as a Bible that maybe just reading during, for when I'm just reading the Bible, is the MacArthur Study Bible. And the reason why I like the MacArthur Study Bible is because I know I agree with him on many issues. And MacArthur often has some very good notes, which are instructive. And that doesn't mean I don't disagree with MacArthur about certain things. I do. But I think it's a very profitable study Bible. And MacArthur's introductory notes are very good. Does a very good job of sketching occasion and theological purpose. And I think he even has a part in there called about theological difficulties, which I think is very profitable to note at the beginning. It stresses the aspects of a certain book that people have wrestled with a lot. Nelson Study Bible is another good one. I've had that in my library for a good 10 years, and if I need a quick reference, a lot of times I'll go to that. And that one is in the New King James Version. I think that's why a lot of times I go to that, because I rotate between the New American Standard and New King James. Those are the two texts I actually use the most as far as translation goes. So the Nelson Study Bible, I thought it, and I'll pass that around. You can see some of the distinctives there. A lot of times they have word emphasis there, and they have a little box that says, okay, here's a word that they highlight, and they give you the translation of the word and the Pauline usage of the word. And I find that helpful. And this is a real interesting one that I had given to me as a gift. This is called the Archaeological Study Bible. And this is a fantastic resource, because what it does is, throughout the book, it gives you so much of the archaeological discoveries and background that help illuminate things. So oftentimes you'll get to a point in here where you read something, and then an archaeological discovery is brought up in the text, which highlights or even confirms the veracity and accuracy of the Bible. So it's a real big, thick one, because they really do pack a lot of information in here. But this is fairly new on the scene. I think this was just published last year. So it's fairly new. But as far as introducing a new study Bible with some real good profit, I think this is really nice, handy. And the amount of information that is packed in here, I mean, you would have to go to so many different resources. And it's difficult to look at archaeological resources, because a lot of times those aren't nice and handy in a book somewhere. So much archaeology is published in scholarly journals and things of that nature, which is hard to track down. I'll get into that in a moment. But real handy, interesting text here. So that's study Bibles. Again, I think study Bibles are good. But again, we always want to be careful to understand the notes are the notes, and read them with a discerning eye. Anybody have anything else they want to note? Any particular study Bibles or that they particularly appreciate? Okay. Let's move on to theological journals. Now, this is an area where a lot of people aren't aware, but so much of scholarly debate and scholarly development occurs in theological journals. Three that I'll note here, three primary, for the most part, conservative journals. One is Bibliotheca Sacra, which is out of Dallas. Trinity Journal, which is out of Trinity, and JETS, or the Journey of the Evangelical Theological Society. Now, what theological journals have are usually short scholarly essays about a certain point that is basically getting thrown out there into the realm of ideas for other people to wrestle with, to refute or to think, well, this is good. This is some really good scholarship here. I think we should develop this. That's really what happens a lot in scholarly journals. And there are so many theological journals. I am going to pass around a book here. If you want to get a good idea of theological journals, a lot of times if you're going to look at a scholarly work or even a commentary, look at their bibliography. And a lot of times, like for instance, this book, this is a book, a scholarly work on the kingdom of God and the teachings of Jesus. But in the beginning, he notes his sources. And here, under the modern sources, he lists all of the journals he consulted. So this page is the journals, this page, and this page. Those are all the various journals he consulted. So if you want to take a look at that, some of them you'll recognize, some of them you won't. But again, look under modern sources there. Now, again, with theological journals, you either go and subscribe to all of these and get them every month or quarter, or, again, the best way to get theological journals is to either go to the seminary library, which Bethel Seminary Library has these theological journals, and they basically, when they get archived, they get turned into big books. They basically bind them into big books. So the trouble with that is it's extremely hard a lot of times to do research at that level. And there is a really good computer program which has a bunch of theological journals and all their archives. And with the computer program, you can type in keywords or phrases and draw up all the articles that deal with either that particular verse or that particular topic. And that's very time-saving when it comes to research. So theological journals, there are a lot of good theology and biblical studies done in theological journals. In fact, these theological journals are very much a driving force of our commentaries. Because when I read a commentary often, I mean perpetually, the commentary will be citing some sort of theological journal where a particular issue that the person is wrestling with within the context of the commentary who relate to that, because that issue was tackled at a large level by this particular theological journal article. So I know that's a realm that maybe a lot of you aren't familiar with, but I think it's good to appraise you of it, because a lot of times I know there's been theological issues that I've, you know, wrestled with, and I'm, you know, one of the ways I, you know, as a pastor and as a teacher and as a writer, to think about it, wrestle with it, and study it, I'll check and see if anybody's written a real good theological journal article about it. And oftentimes I found it, and oftentimes there are very good articles about a particular biblical study issue or issue of theology. So theological journals are... And the interesting... Some of the language in these might be a little hard to chew on, because when you get into the scholarly realm, they like to use big words. It's what they do. So, you might need to have a dictionary with you, but the more you read it, the more you'll get used to it. And most of the time, theological journal articles are, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 pages that are still heavily footnoted, but they can be read in one sitting. So, again, another tool of the trade. Any questions on that? Yeah. I think it's called Master's Christian Library, but let me recheck that. I think that's what it's called. I have it, but I've looked at the cover that I can't remember exactly what the name was. I think it's Master Christian Library, though, but I will correct myself if I'm wrong next week. Okay, commentaries. commentaries are very much a great benefit in biblical interpretation. As a preacher, I use commentaries, many different commentaries, often. And commentaries come in really two forms. You have what are called commentary series, which is usually a group of either a group of New Testament books or a group of Old Testament books, or both, that are under really one editor or one overseen by one particular entity. These are some examples of this. The New American Commentary is a really good commentary series. I know both Bob and I appreciate this commentary series a lot. Now, all these are written by different authors. What I mean by that is these commentary series, you'll have, for instance, New American, you'll have the New Testament, but you're not going to find, rarely will you find more than one author. One writer will tackle Matthew, one scholar will tackle Luke, and so on. The reason why that is a really good commentary takes years for scholars to finish. The amount of research that goes in to writing a commentary, a good commentary, is huge. I remember when I was in school, one of my professors was writing a commentary on John. And unfortunately, this is one of my favorite professors. Unfortunately, I think he died before he was able to finish it. But when I was in class, he had already been working on it for several years. And he was only so far, and he said, you know, I still got several years left of research and writing until I can complete James. And we know how big, James isn't like Genesis. It's not that big of a book. But it takes that long. And the reason why is a good commentary is going to, what a good commentary is going to do is it's going to go verse by verse, it's going to give you as much of the historical and literary background that it can. And it's also going to give you all the issues. So when I am looking at a good commentary, and I see that, okay, this particular text, here are some of the translate. For instance, there may be a translation issue. If there's a translation issue, a good commentary is going to highlight that and tell you what the issue is and wrestle with it. If there is an issue regarding historical context, it's going to note that. Okay, here's an issue that's here, and it's going to give us that. And a good commentary is going to sketch the various interpretations of a certain difficult text and then give you the reason, all the reasons, why he sees his interpretation, which he will give you, as the most compelling. So that really is what a good commentary will do. The New American Commentary, I find very valuable. The NIV Application Commentary, it's a different commentary, but it's an interesting one. I think it's worth taking a look at. It's not by any stretch a great commentary, but what the New American NIV Application Commentary does is it has three sections. It takes a section of Scripture, goes original meaning, bridging contexts, and contemporary significance. So it's really not a classic commentary setup. I don't even know if it's the best thing to even call a commentary, but it does do exposition. But it kind of shows the hermeneutical process, which is, I think, kind of the value of the NIV Application Commentary. The standard, I think these are really the evangelical standards in commentaries, probably the one that so many people hold up the highest, is the New International Commentary on the New Testament and Old Testament, or the NICNT and NICOT. Those are very highly respected in the evangelical world. New Testament Pillar Commentary is really good. That's D.A. Carson is one of the editors of that. And I I think D.A. Carson is one of my favorite scholars. So I that's one of the reasons I value that. And I've looked at several of their offerings, and it's a good solid commentary. Expositor's Bible Commentary is another good one. That's one that you can get on disc. I have that one on disc. Kyle and DeLeish is an older Old Testament commentary, but very much a widely read one. Then there's the Word Biblical Commentary. And the Word Biblical Commentary has some absolutely fantastic additions to it. Like, I believe Lane does Hebrews, William Lane, for the Word Biblical Commentary. Some have noted, and I think there's something to this, that some of the word commentaries, it depends on which one you're looking at, they might come across a little liberal here and there. Just a caveat there. But Word is a very highly valued commentary in many circles. And the truth is, though, and I'll pass. Shoot, you know what? I forgot to bring my other commentary. If you could pass these around. I'm going to have her pass around this, too. The NIV Application Commentary, I just wanted you to look at that to see the uniqueness of that, if you want to pass that around. What I have found personally to be the most valuable commentaries are the ones that aren't associated with any set whatsoever. When I go to the SEM library, oftentimes a lot of times commentaries are made. Just someone is commissioned to write a commentary on, Ephesians. For instance, there's a single volume on Ephesians that I consult often. That's at the SEM library. It's just a singular work on it, but it's absolutely fantastic. Great commentary on Ephesians. So any questions on that? I hope I sketched what a commentary should be. A commentary shouldn't be the answer key. Because, in all honesty, often I've consulted two or three different commentaries, and this happened last time I preached, and I didn't see anybody in line or noting that which I saw in the text, and that causes myself to check myself. I really have to be standing on solid ground. But, I didn't see it in their commentaries, but I do think that this is what is going on in this text, so I'm going with it. And then I need to have good reasons why I'm going with it. But, again, the commentaries should help assist, should help refine, challenge. But ultimately, we are to read the Bible with our own hearts and minds. Everybody get that? Any questions on that? Yeah.
There's an older one that I've come across a few times. Actually, I come across it quite frequently, but I've never read it. It's by Matthew Henry. Are you familiar
mm-hmm.
with it?
Yep.
And what's your take on it?
Yeah, it's not that bad. The only problem with Henry, number one, I have the abridged version. So it really, the problem with a lot of commentaries, and I'm not knocking Henry's. I think Henry's has profit. A lot of commentaries are just flat-out interpretation. This is here, and this is what this means. Which is fine. I mean, that's certainly fine. But for me in my studies, what I like to find in a commentary is the sketching of all the issues that are in the text. And that's why you get commentaries that sometimes are that thick. A lot of times commentaries sometimes just read like sermons. A sermon isn't a commentary in the way we are thinking of it now. A sermon is a different genre, so to speak. A good resource there. D.A. Carson has a book called the brain cramping here. Can't remember the exact title. I'll get it for you. But it's a survey of the of commentaries, and basically Carson going through commentaries, and saying, okay, these are profitable and these are maybe less profitable for your studies. It's kind of for a pastor. It's good because I very highly respect Carson, and when he tells you, you know, these are some really great works that sketch out the issues. It saves me time at the Sem Library, you know, looking through some kind of substandard commentaries that maybe don't really wrestle with the issues. I'll get it for you next week. Has to do with commentary survey, though. Yeah.
Well, on this whole idea of commentaries, too, because sometimes when you you can be sitting underneath a Bible teacher, or maybe you're talking to other people, and you know you're thinking, we're reading the same Bible. How are they seeing something this way? And then you realize, well, they use a Schofield's Study Bible, or they use a Douay Rheims or something. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and everybody wants to adhere to their commentary almost, you know, more almost like a religion in a way.
Yeah.
But, you know, so when you come to battle some of these things, for instance, like you guys were talking last week about dispensationalists or covenant theology mm-hmm. kinds of people or hyper-dispensationalists, and you don't know right away which view they're coming from. And so then, you know, you leave this conversation and you go home and you research and you look it up, and then you find out, oh, they have this dispensation, that's why, or this particular theology, this
yep.
is why they see it that way.
Yep.
But it's just like, I wish sometimes that they would just be right up front and say, this is why, you know, this is what we're saying, why we say it. You know,
yeah.
So you have some kind of clue, because otherwise you're out there kind of just not
knowing.
Where
is this coming from?
Right, and it can take weeks or months just for someone like me who never heard of it before.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I know, and I agree, and that's, you know, and the thing is for me, you know, I kind of consider myself a theological mutt. Meaning, I have bits and pieces. I you really couldn't take my theology and throw it into some particular camp. And, you know, a lot of times that gets me, a lot of people mad at me. You're not Reformed because you're not all millennial. You know, well, no, I believe in the Reformed, you know, doctrine of salvation, but no, I don't agree with amillennialism, and here's why. Because I don't think it's biblical. And again, that's why I think we really need to come down to it, that we have to be primarily scriptural. Primarily scriptural. And if we run into something in the scriptures that go up against a tradition that we maybe were brought up in, or we're sympathetic to, we need to reject the tradition and put ourselves under the scriptures. And that goes with when we're reading commentaries, we may, or books, you know, anything. You know, all these tools that we have are fallible, but the Word of God is infallible. So we always have to keep that in mind and be primarily informed by the Word. What time is it? Okay. Computer programs, let me just... here's just a couple of ones that I have, all of these. That's why I know them. Bible Master is put out by the Lachman Foundation. That's the New American Standard, really the people who put out the New American Standard Bible. It's a good Bible software program. Libronics or Logos is just brilliant, loaded software. And Lord willing, Bob is going to come in next week and do a demonstration on that for us. If not, I'm going to try to get a crash course with him to find out all the neat things that he does with it. Because I have this software. I've had it for a few months. And it's overwhelming how much is there. And Bob has been working with it for a much longer time, so I think he'd be a better demonstrator of it. And then Aegis software. Aegis is one. A lot of this you can look up on the Internet. I know Aegis has a lot of church history and things of that nature. A host of others. You can look it up. So, again, I think computer programs, if you're computer savvy, you're going to save yourself time and money by getting resources in this manner.
I'd like to offer one that I use a little bit that's free. It's called eSword.
Yeah, people have brought that up every single time I've done this course is eSword. I understand it's fantastic and it's free. Go ahead.
E-sword.net. You can download it free. It's got tons and tons of different Bibles, commentaries, dictionaries. It's got like works of Josephus in there. There's a lot of stuff that's there that's free of charge. But the downside is that all of their stuff is public domain, so you're going to get older versions of the Bible. If you want like a NASB, you got to pay for that. It's like $20.
Yeah.
I think they might have an NIV. Another, if you're a Mac user, is MacSword, MacSword.com. It's not as nice as eSword, but it's got some of the same basic stuff. If by some strange chance there's somebody here that uses Linux, the Sword Project is actually where MacSword comes from. It's they ported Sword Project over to the Mac.
Okay. But,
yep. Sword, like like the sword of the spirit.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. A lot of people have brought that up. Another one is Bible Gateway. I think it's, is that .net or .com? BibleGateway.com. I go there to get, if I don't have, if I'm away from my home computer, I'll go there, and I need to get the scripture, I'll go there.
If any of you like pocket PCs, Laridian makes a great program, Laridian.com, and I've got the New International Version, the NSAB, and the King James all in here. You can add commentaries. You can add notes by pressing on the number of the verse. It opens up a page. You can type in or write in notes. So a lot of times when I'm here, you know, if you're talking about a verse during the, you know, Sunday service, I can write it just like you'd write in the notes of your Bible.
Great.
So it's a neat little program. I think the program itself was like under $20, and there's just cost for the particular Bible versions you want to download onto it.
Cool.
So really handy.
Thank you, Brian. Yeah, there's just, I mean, we can kind of, this is, like I said, this is the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we are so blessed with all this to aid us. So, you know, let's use it. And, but ultimately, to be centering on getting into the Word itself, and coming away with the proper understanding of the Word, and through that, fixing our eyes on Jesus. That is what all these things are for. And that's why I've added this, or I put this in this class, is just so you know of these things. And this isn't just for the scholarly, or those who are in quote-unquote professional ministry. This stuff is for all of us, because we all are called to be Bereans. Okay, we are running out of time, so what I want to do here is give you next week's final assignment, the final exposition. Okay, I've given you a situation here. I'm going to read this. You are at the dentist's office, and someone sees you reading some Christian literature. This individual strikes up a conversation with you about the Christian faith. As the conversation proceeds, you find this person believes in sinless perfectionism. They hold that if one sins after conversion, they are lost. They offer Hebrews 10:26 as a proof text. You get called in the office, but the individual wishes to continue the conversation via email. Using the principles we've learned, explain to this individual why their interpretation is incorrect, and demonstrate why your interpretation is the correct understanding of the passage. Now, let me sinless perfectionism is kind of a big umbrella. There's a big theological umbrella here. There is a certain sect of people who believe in sinless perfectionism, and these people used to always come to, I went to Mankato State University, well now Minnesota State University, for 2 years before I transferred to Bethel to study the Bible. And they'd always show up during the spring, and they were sinless perfectionists, and they would say, you know, if you're a believer and you've sinned or are sinning in any way, shape, or form, you're lost. You know, and then when they were pressed, if they were sinners, they would say, well, no, I'm not a sinner. I don't sin. And this is one of the texts they use to support their case. So, let's read the text quick. It's on the next page. I gave you the text so you can, if you want to take notes on that for next week, you can. For if we go on sinning willfully after receiving the knowledge of truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sin. So I'm just going to read that. So you can see how someone could read that text and use it as a proof text. Okay? So your assignment And next week is your week. Your assignment is, using all that we've learned, demonstrate, number one, why his interpretation is wrong, or this individual, whoever it was, our imaginary man. And then, through studying the scriptures, you can use anything. You can use commentaries to help assist you. You can, be careful. That's another thing I gotta say. Be careful of the internet. Be real careful of the internet. The internet is full of crazies. And it's probably not the best place. I mean, use it, but be real careful. There is a lot of garbage out there.
Be discerning.
Yeah, be very discerning, especially on the internet. This is where people, people who can't get published anywhere else, let's throw it on the internet. So be careful with that. But that being said, if you want to get on the internet and see if there are any good online commentaries that may help you out, get in. Little hint here, focus on that sitting willfully, and then read the whole context here. And next week is your week. I'll be with you. I'm going to give you my interpretation, my understanding of the passage. But next week's your week. So, and every time I do this course, I it's a difficult text. I don't give, easy ones. So, this is what I want you to do next week. It's always a fun thing to wrestle with the scriptures. And this is one that I think it well demonstrates how we need to utilize the principles of biblical interpretation. So that is that. No preterism again this week, I guess. Hopefully next week. Next week, the plan is we're going to get into this text, wrestle with the text. I'm going to demonstrate that Libronics system. Either me or Bob will, if Bob's up to being here tomorrow or next week. And then, it's just wide open. I'll get to finally next week, Lord willing. I will get to the more on the futurism versus preterism. And then it'll just be wrap up. So, thank you. And one more week to go. See you.